to friends and hustlers living on the streets of Portland. Again, that's My Own Private Idaho at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater in Portland. This month, La Peña's show features artists from the Bay Area and France, including Andrea La Calena, Cristo Cortez, and Ricardo Diaz y Brenna McDonald. Again, that's Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater, located at 55 Northeast Farragut Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, David Byspiel, is a poet, essayist, editor, teacher, and critic. He's the author of 5 books of poetry, most recently Charming Gardeners, and The Book of Men and Women, which was named one of the best books of the year by the Poetry Foundation and won the Oregon Book Award in Poetry. Byspiel oversaw the revival to national prominence of the magazine Poetry Northwest, serving as its editor from 2005 to 2010. He's a member of the board of directors of the National Book Critics Circle, and from 2012 to 2014 was the chair of its award committee in poetry. And he is also the founder of the Attic Institute of Arts and Letters in Portland, Oregon, a haven for writers whose faculty has included everyone from Matthew Dickman and John Raymond to Kim Stafford and Cheryl Strayed. Byspiel's honors include a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Literature, a Wallace Stegner Fellowship, and a Lannan Fellowship. He's a faculty member in the Creative Writing Program at Oregon State University and also in the Rainier Writing Workshop. And he's here today to talk about his new book, A Long High Whistle, a collection of the best of his monthly essays on poetry and what became, over the course of 10 years, the longest-running newspaper column on poetry in the United States. Library Journal, in its starred review of A Long High Whistle, describes it as one of the best books about reading poetry you will ever find, a perfect introduction to how to read a poem. Byspiel doesn't tell us how to read. Instead, he simply shows us. Welcome to Between the Covers, David Byspiel.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, you start The Long High Whistle with a statement, and I just want to read the statement to start out. I believe that most people have little trouble reading a poem, that most people like poetry, that most people crave the pure pleasure of poems, and that most people want a poem that's not too obvious. And I was wondering about that statement as I read it, whether it was a simple, straightforward statement or whether there was some provocation in the statement. And the reason why I ask is because I had two feelings in myself as I read the statement, because I think there's something true and instinctual that people seem to gravitate towards poetry when they're younger, and writing it, reading it, it seems like a natural thing that we do, and it sticks for some people and doesn't stick for some people. But then on the other hand, I know a lot of well-read, literate people who are intimidated by poetry or steer clear of poetry because they don't understand how to enter it. Tell us about how you open A Long High Whistle and how simple or complicated that invitation is at the beginning.
That's a great question. And I think it's the question that just about anybody wrestles with who's trying to read poems, whether they're initiated or not. I totally agree with you that for most readers, there's a primitive desire just to be excited by the language itself. You know, hinks, minks, the old witch stinks is still kind of electrifying,
right?
Even if she's jumped into the frying pan. And at the same time, there's this other urge, just more analytic, trying to parse out what the difference is between a hinks and the minks, and, you know, trying to understand what those terms and languages and metaphors are to us as we read the poems. And so on the one hand, I think that there is a simplicity to reading poems if you feel comfortable being lost. And I mean, all poems make you lost, but being comfortable, you know, traveling in a foreign country, as it were, where you don't know the particulars, you don't know the streets, you don't know the language necessarily, but you're open to being alert, finding the passageways, looking for the little cafe you like to go to in the evening and meet up again with your friends. And at the same time, allowing yourself to be stunned, awed, in wonder, mystified, and accepting that that's okay. I go to a movie. I'll go to a museum, look at a painting. I listen to music. And like anybody else, and I don't understand every single solitary thing about what's going on in any of those forms. I don't even try to.
Would you think the intimidation comes from a confusion on how to enter a poem? And what I mean by that is you have this first essay where you compare the going into a poem and going into a, and learning the streets of a city, which you alluded to in your comments just now. But when you read fiction, you often go in with an expectation with a lot of fiction that you're going to understand on one read. And it's clear from your first column about getting to know a poem that the correct expectations are not that you're going to read it once. Just like you do when you go out to dinner multiple times in a foreign city and you're connecting its history and its current contemporary scene together, it requires a multiple exploration. Does that sound right to you?
That I think that is my experience too. I guess maybe it's unfair to ask people when they come to a poem to have the expectation that you need to sort of poke around it first and then read it and then read it again, especially the shorter poems. I mean, I don't think, you know, you have that same expectation for the longer narratives or the sort of more traditional epics. It's a different appreciation. So I guess what we're talking about really is what's called lyric poetry, which I guess I would define as, you know, a single voice speaking out loud on a single theme, more or less, surrounded a particular metaphor, more or less, speaking out loud more or less to nobody. Right? Yeah. Those are a lot of sort of cagey dodges there. And I think that one difference for me to try to think about in terms of fiction is when I read a novel, I know right from the get-go, I'm trying to read it to get out of myself. Hmm. I want to be brought into the narrative and the story and the characters and the scenarios and so on and that are different from my life. At least that's an expectation I have reading fiction. When you read a poem, and I know fiction shares some of this, but when you read a poem, the assumption one should make, I think, is you're the speaker of the poem. That the only way in order to sort of bring it into your body is to make it your experience. And so learning how to calibrate your own experiences with what's going on in the poem, there's some bridges there, and some of those bridges are a little rickety. And some of them are more accessible right from the beginning. They're more sturdy bridges. That can be very exciting if you're willing to kind of get nervous on a bridge.
I do love the language of, I think, what you call cultural mapping, this idea of moving in geography, in space and time, in relation to, as metaphor for moving through a poem itself. That was very compelling to me.
Well, I do think that most poems follow a sequence. The first, and you can use these as map points, I guess. One is that at the top of the poem, usually there's some revelation for why the poem is really even being initiated in the first place. Why has somebody decided to say, oh, I'll just use John Keats as an example because it's simple. My heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense as though of hemlock I had drunk. My heart aches. That's answering something. The aching heart that happened before that poem, Ode to a Nightingale, happens before he starts to speak. And so once he announces the heartache, then the poem is going to go through a sequence of, I'll just call them trials or discoveries, changes, in which you're trying to understand what are the various aspects of the heartbreak. And in that poem, he tries to transfer his heart up to the nightingale, the bird, and realizes that it's impossible and that he's got to live with his own pain. Well, once he returns and understands that he has to live with his own pain, even though he wants to stay with the nightingale, he's got to tell us about that story. And right. then and transfer that to us, make a communion with us as the reader. And so I think if people will, when they read poem, if they will understand at least that much, there's a reason for the poem to be spoken that's often revealed early. what are all the trials that go on in there, and then what's the gift that we're being given at the end?
That kind of reminds me a little bit of the Auden advice when he says that when he confronts a verbal contraption, mm-hmm. the two questions are, how does it work and who is the person that is inhabiting
it? That's right. That's right. And he goes further and says, what is their view of the evil one?
Oh, really?
Yeah. What is their idea of good and evil? Huh. Like, what's their vision of the world?
Right.
Can you see that in a poem?
Huh.
Auden says something else, which I've always loved. Asked by the question, you know, what advice would you give to a young poet, you know, for someone first starting out in poetry? And he said, well, it depends what they ask. If they come up to me and they say, I'd like to be a poet, and I say, why? And they say, well, I have a lot to say. Then Auden said, I would say, shake their hand and say, well, good for you, you're on your way. And he said, if someone else came up to him and said, I would like to become a poet, and Auden asks, why? And that person answered, well, I just love the mystery of words and the sounds of words. Auden says, I would take that young poet to lunch.
That's great.
Yeah.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to poet David Byspiel about his collection of columns on poetry, A Long High Whistle. What were some of the gateway poets for you? And also, to flip that around, what are ones that you gravitate towards to try to hook people into poetry?
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer the first part, I think the first poets I really paid most attention to, even before I was writing, were Walt Whitman and John Keats, probably for different reasons. And I'm not sure I could have articulated what those reasons are. Now I can tell you what the consequences have been. With Whitman, I appreciate his interest in the cosmic that he reveals in the minutest things. All those lists that he has, all those catalogs, mm-hmm. They have fidelity to exactitude, and I appreciate that. And they accumulate their emotional power, for me at least, because of that. Keats is a different species altogether. He's interested in the perfection of the art itself, and it's a paradox. He's interested in the paradox that you're trying to write about something in the most perfect form, the most perfect order of words, and so on. And that becomes a vessel. He calls it a vessel that you give to someone else. But then once it's released from you, you aren't perfected. You remain imperfect. And that's a difficult pill for, I think, a lot of writers to take. But I took to that pill.
Yeah.
I enjoyed my imperfection. and using the poems to try to do something else.
Right.
As far as suggesting poets, you know, entryway, you know, gateway poets, that's a harder one to answer. I mean, there are some, it depends what it is you want them to enter, right? If you want them to understand kind of the emotionalism of poetry, you know, its core emotional glories, You pick a poet, like, you know, for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
If you want them to understand, it's kind of this narrative potential, you pick a poet for that reason.
Sure.
You want them to understand sort of the crazy uses of language and, you know, poets that use only 23 of the 26 letters in the alphabet and only six of the
right.
parts of speech, well, you pick a poem for that. And mostly I think you're just trying to jostle them into seeing, it's a ricochet, you know, where you're trying to get them pushed a little. It's like bumper cars, trying to push them somewhere in which they can respond with something,
mm-hmm.
and respond in kind and kind of mirror it. I mean, you know, monkey see, monkey do. And imitation, as with other studies, has sort of been the approach I've used the most.
You have two essays in A Long High Whistle that follow each other, one called Occasion of the Non-Occasion and another One Kind of Knowledge. And in the former, you say, and I'm putting these together partially because I think there are a whole bunch of productive contradictions in this book that I think are really useful. And this is potentially one. In the former essay, you say, if poetry did not exist for even a single day, that would be the day it gets invented. And elsewhere, you say that no culture has existed without poetry, that poetry is central to being human. But then in the following essay, you confront the question of poetry's small audience. Compared to the other arts, how it's never aimed to be a mass art, it doesn't sell well, and isn't very widely read in comparison to, say, novels or memoirs. How are both of these things true in your mind? How do you grapple with that weird knot?
Well, that's a good question. I think that poetry would have trouble being a mass art. It would take too many people to make a poem. You know, the mass things that get produced, mass produced for mass audience, take a lot of cooks in the kitchen. You know, who are trying to create it, market it, and sell it to the world. Poetry has the expectation that you're predisposed, and the poems are out there, and their invitation to you is, you know where to find us. We're down the lane here, past the forest, where the campfire is. We're the people in the crowded party who are talking in the kitchen, right? And it requires quietness, because what you have is one poet talking to one reader, listener, at a time, mm-hmm. and it's intimate in that way, just as you know you and I are talking right here. And that's why I think it has that essentialism to it, and that most people, you know, you and I read, and I read a lot of books of poems. For various reasons. Most people do not read poetry the way I do. They might have one poem that they may have had quite a long time ago, you know, back in the day.
Right.
You know, like the music listened to. It's their Lynyrd Skynyrd. And that's all they need.
Yeah.
They can carry that for the rest of, they don't need the newest book by so-and-so.
Right.
And so that smallness is actually gigantic inside of them. And on the other hand, the other mediums are better at a larger audience. I mean, because I think of fiction and film in particular, especially with the movies, their ability to create a bridge that we can access right away happens, and create exposition to explain how to get onto that bridge is much more common and much more expected by an audience than a poem. Last night I saw that very lovely movie, Mr. Holmes. I think it's called Mr. Holmes.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
About Sherlock Holmes, 35 years after he's retired, with Ian McKellen. And it's a beautiful movie. But I realized, even watching it, that two things were happening to me. One was, well, I know the Sherlock Holmes stories, and I already care about Sherlock Holmes. And so I was already predisposed to care about the aging Sherlock Holmes. If it was just about an aging gentleman living on the, you know, on the coastline with a housekeeper and her young boy, that would have been a lovely story too. But it was Sherlock Holmes, and I already have an emotional response to him. It also, the movie also modeled a movie called, I forget who directed it, called The Shootist, that was John Wayne's last movie. And he played an aging gunslinger, that's the Western version of Sherlock Holmes, dying of cancer, who had come to this boarding house with a mother and her son. The mother was played by Lauren Bacall, and the son was played by a teenage Ron Howard.
Huh.
And he's going to have one last shootout before he dies, and he expects to die in the shootout. He's the gunslinger who was never killed. Well, it's about John Wayne. It's about the iconic figure of John Wayne as the Western hero all those years. And so if you care about John Wayne, that Hollywood, the figure of John Wayne, well, then you care about that movie.
Right.
Otherwise, he's just a wretched old man who used to kill people.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to poet David Byspiel about his collection of columns about poetry, A Long High Whistle. You mentioned this thing that you come to the movies with, which I do think you can come to poetry with in the same way. Like if you, and one of the things that I love most about this collection of columns actually is your discussion of the way poems and poetry are in conversation across time. You mentioned in the beginning around the cultural mapping that when you walk through a new city or you walk through a new poem, that you're looking for what's distinctive and what's connective. You're looking for what's historical and what's contemporary. And similarly, the different generations of poets are in conversation with other historical poets, mm-hmm. or trying to distinguish themselves against certain poets, either contemporary or not. Can you return to this issue, which isn't unique to poetry, but is certainly part of poetry? And one of the parts that I really loved is what poets tried to do in the shadow of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare is written, he's casting one of the longest shadows in literature now. And what do you do? I mean, you can't one-up him necessarily in his form. So tell us a little bit about poetry right after Shakespeare.
Sure.
And what some of the strategies were of that generation of poets were.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to preface that, I would say that one of my purposes for the column, and you know, I wrote it in the Oregonian for 10 or 11 years, and was to talk about how to read a poem every month, and that you could be both informed about how to read a poem, so you could be in a position to walk into the movie, the quote, movie theater of the poem, much better than you were if you didn't read poetry at all. Well, the poets following Shakespeare had a big fat problem, and that was how do you top Shakespeare? And every generation, okay, let's go with an assumption, every generation wants to sweep aside the generation that came before it. That's natural. That's what you grew up reading. You feel it as somewhat of a challenge. You're both informed by it and also repulsed by it. And boy, how do you get repulsed by Shakespeare, who was obvious even then as the great figure in British letters? Well, these poets, I'm thinking of Alexander Pope and Jonathan Swift in particular, and there are other people around them, they determined very quickly that, well, Shakespeare's great and all, but he's not perfect. You know, his rhymes aren't perfect, his meters aren't perfect. And so they do what most patricidal generations of writers do. They leapfrogged over Shakespeare to the classicists of ancient Rome and ancient Greece and looked for writing which was, they took to be perfect, hence classical. And so that period in the 19th and the 18th century that followed Shakespeare becomes the new Augustan period. And what their interest was, it was to write perfect forms, to reanimate old forms. So instead of writing an epic poem, Pope writes a mock epic poem. And because he also wants to write satire, which Shakespeare doesn't do that much of. So they were also looking for places, no, I don't know if someone's going to call in and say that there's plenty of satire in Shakespeare, but that was not his main literary focus. Well, while those Augustan, if I can just take the story farther, if those Augustan writers of the 18th century were interested in decorum and meter and perfection and in social ills, you know, A Modest Proposal, which was not poetry, but is written in that era. The poets that come later, John Dryden, William Wordsworth, John Keats, William Blake, Shelley, they just thought, could we have somebody have a drop of blood? Could somebody feel something, anything?
Well, you do say that Wordsworth changes everything.
He does.
So what does that mean? What happens when he arrives on the scene that resets the stage in poetry?
And we're still I think in the era that Wordsworth created. What Wordsworth does is he looks back at the Augustans, and I have to say Wordsworth was born in that century. He's educated in that Augustan century, the 18th century. He publishes his first book in 1795. And he looks at the writing and says, this is fine and all, but I can't feel anything. And I don't feel like this language is understandable by normal people, and it's not written in a language that, as he says, is spoken by everyday people. And he also felt that the writing didn't have any meditative aspect, which is about longing. And so he wanted the writing to be, as he said, recollected, have a sense of being recollected in tranquility. And then once you got into the writing, you wanted to make the reader feel like it was happening in that moment. And so he begins to write about more natural subjects, more organic subjects, the countryside. He lived up in the Lake District. Keats begins to write about, who follows Wordsworth, My Heart Aches, is his poem, Ode to a Nightingale begins. He wants to write about how he feels about the world and as he confronts mortality. And this goes on again and again. The early 21st century poets reject that romantic impulse. They live in a world that's more chaotic and more fragmented, and they start to write in that to simulate that. So that's how you get a poem like The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. Later poets, say in the 50s and 60s in the United States, sort of begin to reject that fragmentation, or looking for something that connects the psyche, a lot more Jungian kind of view. And you get poets like Robert Bly and Galway Kinnell and W.S. Merwin and so on. And some poets are really great at straddling it all. I'd say for me, an American poet who really figured out how to straddle all that at once, and that's rare, is Audrianne Rich. She was able to write privately and publicly, almost in the same prepositional phrase. And I have a lot of respect for that. I have a great deal of admiration for her work. Love her poems.
Since we're on the topic of Rich, one of the other productive contradictions, I think, that happens in this book is around politics and art. You have one column where... you have one column called To Witness and to Sing, where you say, I've always been leery of overtly political poetry. Yet at the same time, a lot of the people you put forth, Adrienne Rich, at one point Allen Ginsberg, and many others, and you yourself, who've written for Politico and have written a column for Poetry Magazine that really exhorts the importance for poets to be engaged citizens. So tell us about your leeriness about political poetry and your desire to push poets to be politically engaged.
I think my leeriness begins by a general leeriness with propaganda. I'll try to use two different terms. So there's political poetry, which I think is poetry about social relationships in the civic sphere, the personal, you know, the identity in relationship to the community. That to me seems, that's what political is and how you arrange your relationships. I think what I'm most leery about is partisan poetry. Hmm. Poetry which beats a drum for a particular partisan view, whether it's blue poetry or it's red poetry, you know, you're just singing to the choir and you're extolling some propaganda.
So there's no question at its center, no mystery at its center.
That's right, and no metaphor. I mean, no real honest metaphor. It's about persuasion rather than an interest in change and discovery.
So you could utilize all the language and interests of politics and not have a partisan poem.
Yep, that's right.
I mean, I think of a lot of idle poetry today. It's Terence Hayes or Claudia Rankine that is very politically charged, but isn't partisan.
That's right. I mean, I think in Claudia Rankine's case with her latest book, Citizen, that's a an interesting book to talk about on this question. I think on the one hand, when she wants to be most partisan and most ideological, I should say, and I really like the book. I was on the committee that chose it for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And I was, it's a book I've been thinking about quite a lot. But when she wants to be most political, and I mean partisan, she writes in prose. Hmm. And when she wants to be most writing areas that are where there's the most discovery and the most mystery, she then returns to verse. And that may be a distinction.
That's interesting. Yeah. And that book is interesting in how it leaps from prose to lyric essay or poetry and also to image.
That's
so
right.
There's a way in which that collage and juxtaposition unsettles every component of it.
That's right. And she calls it an American lyric. It's the second book she's called that, you know, as the subtitle. And I think what she's proposing there is that collage of verse, prose, and then images is what lyric does. It takes this thing and think about it alphabetically. Instead of going A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, etc., the lyric begins with H, moves to Z, maybe has a run of A, B, C, then it goes to L, then it circles back to A, and that's what she thinks of as lyric. And so those different forms, those different means are her way of advocating for a lyricism of political content.
Can you speak a little to the feedback and the viral nature of the Poetry Magazine essay that you wrote about being a poet citizen? Maybe just orient our listeners to the nutshell of what you were saying,
sure.
And maybe one or two of the most memorable responses that you received.
So I wrote a piece in Poetry Magazine some years ago that advocated for poets to be both poets and citizens in the world. Now, there are some caveats. One is, I said very clearly in the piece early on, it's none of my business what a poet decides to do with their life and how they are a poet and how they write their poems or live in the world. And I showed models of poets that had no interest in poetry. I mean, if you in politics, if you read John Keats, if you read Emily Dickinson, it's hard to know that we went through a great civil war. You read John Keats, it's hard to know that it comes after the French Revolution. You just don't see it. It's not in the work. And those are two poets I adore. And I was also, the other caveat is I was not, and I said in the piece, I was not trying to advocate for people to write political poems. What I was advocating for was them to use their powers as poets and their place in the culture as poets, as imaginative thinkers and who have skill sets in language, to use that in the public arena outside of poetry, to represent not the poet's point of view, I mean all the poets, but to represent metaphor's point of view about events and to try to disabuse people of cliche metaphors that get, that we use to, at a most reductive level. I don't know why this one comes to mind. I think of the 2000 campaign for president and Al Gore, I don't know how many times, talked about putting Social Security in a lockbox.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
A lockbox. And you wanted to say, well, who has the key? What kind of key is it? What's the code to that lockbox? Or I remember Supreme Court Justice, now Chief Justice John Roberts, saying in his testimony to Congress that he saw being a judge, as a justice, as being like an umpire. And everyone thought that was such a great, and in baseball, for pitchers, calls the balls and strikes. And I wanted to say, that's too reductive. What's your strike zone? Okay? Do you like them high or low?
Right.
All right? There's more to the metaphor. And that's what I meant by metaphoric thinking in the public sphere. I got to do it for 4 years, almost every day at Politico, and it was a real charge. And I will say, some of those political professionals, they're good, and they're good at language. Mm. And I just felt it was a question worth raising. Some of the feedback was, anytime a poet goes into the public sphere without their poems, it's bad for poetry, because that's not what a poet is supposed to do. Some of the other feedback, negative feedback, was, well, when I write a poem about the a seed that's going to grow into a watermelon, and I'm not talking about politics at all, I'm just talking about the what binds us together in life, that's also political, mm-hmm. by turning your back to it. And so those are valid responses.
Yeah.
And I just really wanted to start the conversation about it.
And you did.
I sure did.
Well, what do you think of the Yeats quote that you cite? We make out of the quarrel with others rhetoric, but of the quarrel with ourselves, we make poetry.
I think that's pretty nifty quote. I've used it. I love it. I do. Yeah. He has another little poem, which I have in the book, called Politics, which he's describes being asked his opinion about some event. I could read it. It's very brief. And instead, he just wants to look at the... He wants to look at something that fills his eyes with beauty.
Yeah. Why don't you read it?
Sure. This poem by W.B. Yeats called Politics, he wrote during the 1930s with World War II on the horizon. It's very brief. It's maybe about 10, 11 lines. And it goes, how can I, that girl standing there, my attention fix on Roman or on Russian or on Spanish politics? Yes, here's a traveled man that knows what he's talking about. And there is a politician that has read and thought. And maybe what they say is true of war and war's alarms. But, oh, that I were young again and held her in my arms.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to poet David Byspiel about his collection of columns on poetry, A Long High Whistle. Another interesting part of this book is you wrote a series of columns comparing the history of British and American poetry, and then also some columns on what makes American poetry distinctive, or begins to make it distinctive, and you contrast British song to American speech. So could you tell us a little bit about that series?
Well, I owe almost all of my thinking on those two subjects, first to Joseph Brodsky and second to Stanley Plumley, two poets and critics. It's Stanley Plumley who said that American poetry was like speech barking back at song. And what he was addressing was the idea that American poetry's predominant tendency, I guess I would say, and history, has been free verse. It's unrhymed and irregularly metered lines of poetry, and even prose poetry. As opposed to British verse, where the tradition has long been metrical writing and rhymed writing, though there's a lot of variability there. And what he felt was that even when you're writing unrhymed and unmetrical lines of poetry, there are still meter in your making, and there's still rhyming going on. There are echoes. You're just trying to distort them, or they're being distorted naturally, organically, because you're not adhering to them in a pattern. And so he took that to be a distinctive characteristic of American poetry, that our forebears of British poetry are still underneath the ground of our speech. But speech was more important, and so was the sentence. I think it's a little bit technical. Brodsky had a wonderful way of talking about the difference between British and American poetry. He said that when a British poet, this is his anecdote, when a British poet goes into the forest to write a poem and sits down at a rock among some trees and looks around and begins to craft his or her poem, the first thing she has to do is describe what has happened here at this crossroads, in this forest, in the history of Britain, the continent of Europe, and in British literature. And then she can say, here's what's happening to me now. Because the geography is so small and the history is so long in the literature. He says when an American poet goes into the woods and walks to a crossroads, and he was thinking of someone like Robert Frost, goes to a crossroads and sits down in front of a tree and looks at a tree, that poet thinks, nothing has happened here in American literature ever. And can just immediately begin to talk about identity and the self and the relationship to the natural world. And so he extrapolated from those two stances that that was a core difference in American poetry and British poetry. And I think that's why American poetry now, is so interested in anything that's new and trying to create as much juxtaposition as possible to try to stay in that flavor, that every time you begin to speak in a poem, you're re-identifying yourself in a brand new place. I mean, that is, I think, one of the great motifs of American life.
And you've also mentioned that American poetry often is a mix of high and low diction, which I would imagine comes from having so much influence from speech.
I think so. And I also think it's our melting pot. And it also thinks it's our being a superpower. And our language is a superpower language.
Well, I wondered about the superpower thing in relationship to the politics, too, because when you mentioned that an American walking into the forest and they don't have a history to confront, but they do have a history. I mean, maybe not a literary history, but we are also marked by our sort of historical amnesia that this culture has, not specific to poetry. There's a certain advantage maybe and disadvantage to that sense of not engaging the historical. I mean, there's the weight for the British person going into the forest of having to confront this huge apparatus of history, but there's also a relationship.
That's right. I think that in that paradigm, it's very much about the former colonies and the colonizer England. You know, it's about the new American identity. And at the same time, there has been something happened in that forest, as you're implying.
Right.
There have been people who have lived in that forest long before Robert Frost walked into that forest. That, to me, just illustrates that American poets, by and large, in this anecdote, in this paradigm, are as culpable of the amnesia you're talking about. But that's changing. I think it's changing in particular amongst the poets of the South. And the American South. In the 50s and 60s, earlier, let's say 40s, 50s, 60s, I think of two poets of the South, James Dickey and Robert Penn Warren. And those poets were writing, they're Anglo poets, they're writing in Jim Crow South, and post-Civil War South, and post-commemorative Civil War South. And they were trying to figure out what is a new way of being a Southerner with this stain of losing the war and the stain of racism and still be a progressive-minded literary thinker. Today, I'd say the leading poets of the South are African-American, and they're really none too happy with Robert Penn Warren and James Dickey, too. And they're trying to assert a fairer, more honest, a less forgetful vision of the past. And there, I think of poets like Natasha Trethewey, Kevin Young, Nikki Finney, Terrence Hayes.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to poet David Byspiel about his collection of columns on poetry, A Long High Whistle. Let's talk a little bit about some of the movements in contemporary poetry that irk you. you have an essay in this called Poise in this collection. And you also, now having finished writing for The Oregonian after 10 years, you're now you write poetry column for The Rumpus.
That's right.
And you had, following your Poetry Magazine viral essay, you had an essay in The Rumpus called Something More Than Style. And in that one, you say, while many of the world's poets are deeply preoccupied with war and hierarchy, with exploitation and power, there's a pervasive sinisterlessness in American poetry. There is hash and rehash of the quotidian, an alarmlessness, a niche of the nada. Deafness has become a substitute for compassion, style a stand-in for thinking and feeling. Self-destructive forms are now glorified over measured insight. And I don't know if this links with the quote you have in the Poise essay, but I'll juxtapose the two, and then you can tell me if you're talking about something differently.
Okay.
What you see everywhere these days in our little magazines and online quarterlies in early 21st century America is a poetry of the addled and the disheveled. Everywhere you look, cosmetic indifference, fleetingness, manufactured distress, automated irony, and rank certainty substitute for emotion, insight, and thought. American poetry has become overexcited, hesitant, misgiven, and uncertain. I would love to, I don't know if those are both two sides of the commentary on the same issue or if they're two different issues in a certain subset of American poetry today, but talk to us about this.
Sure. I do think American poetry has become the things I've described, or I wouldn't have said it. And I think those two dovetail with each other and weren't written that far apart. So, you know, within a couple of years, probably. I think that not only is American poetry addled and overexcited in its ways of talking about the world, so is American television, so is the news, so is MSNBC and Fox News and so on. There's a lot of effort to get attention. And the thing that gets attention is discord, disruption, the addled, outrage. And you could add five other things, right, that you know are attention getters in mass media and social media. And I think that poets who are susceptible to those kinds of ways of those articulations naturally, I mean, I don't blame anyone, but naturally are trying to incorporate that into their writing of poems. To me, it always comes across as not a lot of things. It's not meditative. It's not evaluative. It's not open to being incorrect. It's not uncertain. And those are characteristics of what I was calling poise, being able to be both caring and in awe and also uncertain and vulnerable. Boy, I mean, the piece you wrote that we were talking about a while ago in Oregon Humanities is an example of poise. It's an example of wanting to be close to something, finding that, that puts you at risk that you didn't know you were at risk, and then discovering what was true about the whole experience, both the uncertainty and the certainty. Hmm. That's a quiet, mindful, in the moment way of looking at the world. And there are many poets who write in that vein, and I guess I have a preference for that. What I have a preference for is looking for ways of, I'll just say, mythologizing our experiences. And the poem is the ceremony that shows you what that experience is. And that takes a little quieter tenor, I think, and a little more poised tenor. And then what I run into all the time with, you know, when I travel and do conferences and talk to other younger poets who are trying to figure that out. They're trying to figure out what it is they want to write, honestly. They are attracted to style. They think that style is a route to understanding their inner life, and likely it is for them. But it is a remove from what it is and how it is they see the world.
Well, let's pivot to another way of experimenting, one that that doesn't invite this particular controversy and conversation. You write also in A Long High Whistle about using constraints. So in some respects, traditional poetry is by nature a constraint-based art form. Different forms have a different number of lines or a certain pattern of rhyming. But writing under a fixed form, and you mentioned C.K. Williams's 138-line poems, and you wrote a modified version of the sonnets. Mm-hmm. And there's the value in imposing a constraint on your work. And I wonder if it's shared, if you share the same sentiment when you're talking about like generational conversations. So like the Oulipo movement in France that was responding to the Surrealists, and the Surrealists were saying, you need to free write and there's ultimate absolute freedom. And the Oulipians were saying, no, you liberate yourself through constraint. So the more you force a form, the more you find your liberation through that constraint. So I would love to hear about your take on that conversation.
Yeah. Well, I do think that failure is the engine of creativity for sure. And that whatever means you use to fail in order to figure out what it is you're trying to say is going to be useful to you. And every individual writer has to figure out which one works best for yourself, whatever your obsession is. There is no absolute freedom.
Right.
As a writer. I'll speak about poetry in particular. And I appreciate what some of the conceptualists are trying to do, although I don't think it's going to matter in the end. We're very conservative art. Most of the poems we write, 90% of the poems we write, take place on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper on one side at about a font between about 10 and 12.
And you say that, and it seems obvious when we hear it, but that is a form, a constraint that many people don't recognize that they're using.
That's right.
Because it's so common. Almost invisible.
It's an assumption. It's gravity, really. And I think it's true of prose. Mm-hmm. When the little bell goes off in the typewriter, you move the carriage and go to the next line. There's no thought to it at all, just depending on where you set your margins. And so there's that constraint. You can be as free as you want. You can do all the free writing you want, and you should, within those constraints. But that's a very small space. A.R. Ammons tried to narrow the space once, and he wrote an entire book on adding machine tape. The book's called The Tale of the Tape of the Year. He took an adding machine tape, which is very narrow, put it in his typewriter, and that was his line. And so I think writers and artists are always looking for something to go that pushes them back into the field. We don't play tennis without lines and a net. If you've ever played tennis without a net, you know, you go to a court and there's no net and you play tennis, you spend a lot of time trying to decide whether or not the ball would have gone over the net or not over the net.
Right.
But the game is much more beautiful with a net. And so I think they always have constraints if you'll just admit them. And then you just adding one more constraint. Okay, I'm going to write only on 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, only on one side. I'm going to set my left margin at 2 inches, not 1 inch. And every time I get to the 10th syllable, I'm going to go to another line. That's as arbitrary as saying, I'm going to write it on top of this table. Like, so the constraints are also arbitrary.
Even the classical ones, what makes a sonnet, even
That's
though
right.
it doesn't seem arbitrary because of the storied history of it.
That's right.
is pretty arbitrary.
But the objective, one objective in writing a sonnet, in addition to trying to say something about the way in which you see the world, let's not forget, one objective is, can I use this common form and add my 0.1% of difference? What can I do in this form that is going to expand its possibilities? And so that too is not a fixed item.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to poet David Byspiel about his collection of columns on poetry, A Long High Whistle. I wonder if, depending on the constraint, if you do discover or access parts of your own abilities around language that you wouldn't necessarily find without it. Like, and so adopting different ones as a means to self-discovery.
I think
in expression.
I think intuitively that's right. Absolutely. When you do imitation of someone, a poet, the thing you're most interested in doing, one is, on the one hand, is trying to borrow their sound. But what you're most in search of is where you deviate from their sound, and that you're riding their wave. And when you catch another wave, that's your sound. And then you take away all the imitation and you go with what you've created. And they help you find your identity. Imitations are really important for that reason. The constraints are endless.
Right.
To add another paradox.
Well, let's talk about another mystery in a mystery of being human around language and translation. You talk in A Long High Whistle about a translation that you come across of Keats in Italian. Mm-hmm. But what is your experience in general about reading poetry in translation? And your thoughts on this specific experience around Keats?
Sure. I don't do a lot of translation, so I'm only mostly, I've done very little. And so my response has to be mostly as a reader and not as someone who's done it that much. I think that there are different translational questions. I mean, I'll say the obvious. One is you're trying to render the other language into your language. Let's go Italian to English, because that's what we're going to talk about. Render Italian into English. And you're trying to approximate the Italian into English as close as possible. That's bold. That's really bold to think that you can do that. You can take two languages, or take two languages but don't use the same letters, Chinese into English. That's quite bold for the translator. The other translational stance is, well, I can't do that. That's too bold for me. I'm too humble in front of the problem. And what I want to do is take this amazing thing in Chinese and make it amazing in English. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to worry about all the traditions and histories that that writer was dealing with in their own language. And I'm going to put it in a language so which I can share it to the widest audience I can and be as true to that.
Well, that's sort of like Coleman Barks with Rumi, where mm-hmm. he just writes American free verse yeah. rather than trying to go into the Persian form.
That's right. And those can be side by side. We can't see the world the way a Russian writer sees the world. We just don't have the particular history in our body in order to see that literature that way. But what a poor world we would be if we didn't have Tolstoy.
Right.
If we didn't have Dostoevsky in our language, even flawed as it is. And so the translations are essential for the human community. In the case of the Keats problem, you know, I know the Keats very well, and other people know it better than me, I'm sure. And I tell you what, I think I know it better than Keats because I've read it longer than he did. but the Italian translator made a decision which I thought went against both problems. It neither tried to recreate the poem in Italian the way it was in English, and then it didn't try to keep the spirit of the poem in Italian as it was in English. And I thought that was, you know, that's two strikes.
Right.
And you only get two. And that's what got me upset about it.
Well, in preparing for this interview, I just randomly came across this quote by Ferlinghetti where he says, a poem can be finished, a translation only abandoned,
yeah.
which seems in this spirit. And you have this really wonderful meditation on Anne Carson's Knox, a project where she's exploring her grief around the loss of her brother, and at the same time trying to translate a classical poem that is widely considered untranslatable. And doing this endeavor of trying to translate an untranslatable poem into English obviously is an evocation of the inability for her to translate mm-hmm. her grief into language around her brother.
That's right. That's how I read it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, a translation is a version of the original, just like your memory is a version of events in the past. And you're translating the past. And you can either try to translate it image for image, but things begin to leak out. And so what you end up translating is your emotional response at that moment toward the images and the events of the past. And that changes as you age and presumably get wiser. In the Anne Carson poem, she does an amazing thing with that poem. She basically takes each word, it's a very brief poem, Catullus 101, I think it is, which is an elegy for his brother. And she tries to translate and define each word from the Latin into the English and build a poem out of that. And then try to keep translating the poem based on all this knowledge of that word, and shows the task to be impossible, mm-hmm. ultimately. And so, in some sense, you just have to, here's my version of it. Now, the thing about translations is they age, and they age very quickly. So that's why we always need a new translation of Catullus every generation. We need a new translation of Homer's Odyssey every translation, because our language is evolving and fluid, and our sense of the ancient Greece or Latin or whatever is changing and fluid. We learn more stuff about it. And the other translations into our language are also part of the story of the original. And so translations are always... Well, I was talking about Sherlock Holmes. How many more Sherlock Holmes movies do we need?
It's a good question.
as many as we want to go see.
Right.
Right. We have to keep reinterpreting Sherlock Holmes for our era.
And what are you working on now? Other than the column with the rumpus, do you have a artistic endeavor you're engaged in?
Yeah, I am. Two things. On the prose side, I wrote a series for the rumpus called The Poet's Journey. And I'm finishing that up for a book that's now called A Ladder to the Underground. And it's about being a poet, about how to be a poet in the modern world. How to go from living our everyday life into the imagination, into your psyche, to recover whatever it is that's lost that you're trying to restore through the poem, and then return with that back to the world that's being fluid and moving along and not really thinking about poetry all the time you've been gone. And while you've been changed, it's changing, and where do you calibrate the two? So there's that. That's a piece of prose. And then I'm finishing up a new book of poems. That's a single poem. It's called Republic Cafe. And it's about love in the kind of 9/11 era. And it's about how in moments of intimacy, even just you and I sitting, 5 inches away from each other, for us to have this conversation, or for you to have any conversation with anyone, or especially if it's an intimate, and it's filled with eroticism, is to forget a lot of the tragedies and suffering and violence in the world in order to be in that moment. And yet all of that informs who you are in that moment of intimacy. And so the forgetting is your memory. And I'm trying to write about that paradox.
Mm. That sounds really fabulous.
So that's what I'm working on.
Yeah. I look forward to reading that. I really enjoyed and learned a lot reading A Long High Whistle.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. And I'm really glad to come up here and talk, and these are great questions, and it's a lot of fun.
You've been listening to David Byspiel, poet, essayist, editor, teacher, and critic, and the author of A Long High Whistle. This has been Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. And we are at 91.9 FM Hood River and 104.3 FM Philomath, serving the Willamette Valley. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And Michael Franti and Spearhead playing two Oregon concerts this Friday at Portland's Edgefield and this Sunday at Ben's Les Schwab Amphitheater. Tickets for Michael Franti and Spearhead's once-a-day tour at ticketfly.com and the venue box offices Friday and Sunday.